love ELO? Of course you do. What kind of dim-witted jughead doesn't?
Then listen to Face the Music, an Electric Light Orchestra song-by-song podcast. Every week, I, Eric Paul Johnson, and my co-host, Eric Winsensen, take a song by the Electric Light Orchestra, give the song facts, the history, discuss, tear apart, dig deep into the song itself, give our opinions, chart facts about the singles, and we even consult with the future of humanity on their opinion of the Electric Light Orchestra.
I loved it!
So if you don't want to be a dim-witted jughead, then listen to Face the Music, an Electric Light Orchestra song-by-song podcast. Episodes post every Saturday at midnight Eastern Time
and can be heard on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Mixcloud, TuneIn, and iHeart.
That was stupid as a butthead.
Hello and welcome to Pods Like Us. I'm Martin Quibble, known to my friends as Marv. And this time I'm speaking with Stu Arrowsmith from the podcast Dangerous Amusements, Conversations About Costello. I got the full title in there, Stu. How are you doing?
I'm really well, Marv. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Is that the full title or is it just Dangerous Amusements?
Yeah, it's just Dangerous Amusements, but then I needed, on the artwork, I needed just a secondary line just to give it a little bit more context that it's about Elvis Costello. So I may change that at some point to say the Elvis Costello playlist, I think, as well, because that is one of the directions that we go in each episode, as you know. So, yeah, I may do a little bit of tinkering with that as we go along. But, yeah, Dangerous Amusements is good for me.
You've actually put me into a tangent there that I didn't have in my notes. The playlist, I think that's great that each season you have a different playlist for each season. So to give people some perspective that might not have heard the show before, you each season have a select group of guests who come on and they discuss the history of their fanship and love for Elvis Costello's music. And then you pick, they pick a song from each era of Elvis's music, 70s, 80s, 90s, the noughties, and then 2010 to the present day. Yeah. And then you make a playlist on Spotify for each season based on those songs that they've chosen.
Yeah, that's right. I was looking for a concept and a format for the show. And obviously one thing I could have done, which I was thinking about, would be to have each guest talk about their favourite album and we'd go through it track by track. That's a great format and it's been done on a lot of other music shows as well. But I was trying to look for something a little bit different. So the playlist idea came up. As you've perfectly described it, that's what I ask people to do, pick a different song from each decade of Elvis's career. And what I like about that is that it means that each episode of the podcast spans the full breadth of Elvis's career, because I was a little bit worried that if I was to do an album per episode, we may just be concentrated on certain areas of his career. I mean, everyone talks, don't they, about that opening run of half a dozen albums. He's made great albums all the way through his career, but that half dozen is the thing that everyone always goes to. And I thought, well, people might just all go for that era and we'll neglect the rest of his career. Whereas with the playlist idea and one song per decade, it means that every single episode we're touching on every single part of Elvis's music career. So, yeah, and in fact, for season four, which we've just recently started, I've decided to make it six songs now as well and make the 2020s their own category as well, because we've now had a number of albums in this decade already. We're recording this in 2022. We've already had The Boy Named If, which came out earlier this year. Hey Clockface, which is a terrific record. And then the sort of really fascinating projects he's done, like Spanish Model, where he's had other artists re-record songs of his in Spanish. And then he's done some French language recordings as well. He's done all kinds of stuff. And I thought, well, there's now enough of a catalogue of music in the 2020s that can be a standalone category of its own as well. So yeah, six songs per guest now in each episode. So the one decision I had to make, Marv, was did I just have one playlist for the lifespan of the podcast, however long I'm doing this for? Yep. And obviously Elvis has done 30 odd albums. There are millions of songs for people to choose from. But if you are guest number 50, you know, you've had 49 people before, you picking five songs each, now six, a lot of your favourites may have gone. So I took the decision that it'd be a different playlist for each series. And I don't mind too much if someone in season three picks a song that was picked in season one, because I'm looking for people's own perspective on the song and their experiences of it. So I don't mind too much if a song pops up in multiple seasons. We just don't have duplicates in the same season. But yeah, I think the guests who've come on have picked some fantastic songs. And that's always one of the great thrills, actually, when they send me the email through letting me know which songs they're going to pick. It's like, all right, interesting. Some of them take you by surprise. And I'm always keen to hear the reasoning why they've picked them, you know.
Yeah, well, essentially, because you're doing it on a season-by-season basis, it's good because it's like you're each year compiling a different Elvis Costello compilation album, essentially. Yeah. So each year is a different album. You could look at it that way, each season.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I don't know how many people listen to it for the playlist. You know, I think people are more interested in the episode. The playlist was more for me to give me a concept. But if people do go away and listen to the playlist in order that's been put together, then that's fantastic. And one of the really satisfying bits of doing this is getting messages from people when they either say, I'd never heard this song that your guest picked and I've now gone away and I really like it. Or if you get longtime fans who say, do you know what, I've not listened to that particular record for years, and because guest X has picked a song from it, I've now spent the last fortnight listening to that album nonstop. So yeah, it's really nice if we can point people to different areas in Elvis's back catalogue as well. We're not short of songs or albums to choose from, I don't think, are we?
Absolutely not. And a good part of it for me personally is that even though I have a sort of love of a lot of Elvis's music, there are areas where I'm shady on, because it's a career that I've not really followed as such. So occasionally I love it that your show includes clips from the songs, because then they'll mention it, and while they're talking, I think, oh, that sounds interesting, the way that they're explaining it and the story behind what they see in the song, and then your explanation of the song, and then you play a bit of it, and I'm like, oh, I like that one. But it's killing my bank account, because you do that and I'm suddenly buying it on iTunes, you know, the song.
Elvis will be extremely grateful, I'm sure.
I think Apple Music will be more happy with that. They get more absolutely out of it.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. Oh, good. Well, that is the whole, I mean, it sounds grand to say that's one of the things I hope to achieve with it. But, you know, if it does turn people onto some of Elvis's music that they've not heard before, then that's brilliant. I mean, as I say, I always love it when I get messages from people saying, I've heard this record now because I heard someone talking about it on the podcast. So, yeah, that's great.
Yep. And then a recent one that I listened to, I think somebody picked a song from the album that he did with Burt Bacharach.
Oh, and, yeah, Painted From Memory, yeah.
I love that. That's a lovely album, that is.
Yeah, me too.
And it's part of... So there's something really that I'm... You know, I like Elvis's music on his own, but I think we've sort of discussed this beforehand in passing. I have a sort of interest in where Elvis goes with his collaborations at times, where he'll go somewhere where sometimes you don't expect it in a way. And it's sort of like, I don't know if he's pushing himself as a writer or as an artist. I think it's more that he's just interested in these areas and just wants to see where it goes. In a lot of ways, I compare him to one of his other collaborators, Paul McCartney, where Paul does the same thing. I don't think all the time that Paul's trying to do that either, sometimes he's trying to go where that is to more of a degree than Elvis, but sometimes I just think that they are both people that are interested in music as a whole, and they have an all-round interest in all music, and they just want to see, oh, I'll have a try at this because I'm interested, and then see what happens.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think you can see similarities, can't you, in Paul and Elvis's lives, in that, you know, Paul's dad, as well as being a cotton salesman, was, you know, performed in, what was it, Jim Mack's jazz band in the 20s. Elvis's dad, of course, is Ross McManus, who performed with the Joe Loss Orchestra. So they were exposed to different types of music. And I think what you can pick up from both of them is that they don't see labels on anything. They're not put off by which genre, in inverted commas, people describe a piece of music as. To them, it's either good music or it's bad music. And that leads them to do things that maybe their contemporaries wouldn't do. So you think of 1977. I mean, this is before my time, but 1977, Elvis is on the Live Stiffs tour. This is the height of punk, and he's one of the great heroes of New Wave. And he's singing a Bacharach and David song, "I Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself in the Midst of It All," which you think nobody else would do that. They'd be a bit too sort of shy of even making it known that they liked that kind of music. But Elvis was so single-minded and just loved the music for what it was that he wasn't bothered about whether he was supposed to like it, in inverted commas, or not. And I suppose you can see a similar thing with McCartney as well. From the very early recordings with the Beatles, he would do show tunes. You know, he the first Beatles album, he does A Taste of Honey on there, which you can't imagine if he wasn't there. I don't think Lennon or Harrison would have pushed to do a song like that. But McCartney sees the beauty in that music, doesn't he? And he's not bothered what other people think about it. And I think that makes the two of them just really interesting musicians and songwriters. And yeah, the Burt Bacharach collaboration is wonderful. Painted from Memory is the album, if people haven't heard it, released in 1998. And I've said this once or twice before, but it's one of those albums that, in the right mood on the right day, I might tell you that's my favourite Elvis Costello album. But I instantly want to say, oh, no, but I also love, and then reel off another dozen that I really love as well. But it's one of those that, in the right setting, that album is just absolutely perfect. And, you know, the 12 wonderful songs on there. You're right, a few guests have picked tracks off there as well. And I think it contains some of the highlights of Elvis's career on there. God Give Me Strength is a wonderful song from the movie Grace in My Heart. I still have That Other Girl, which I think got an Oscar nomination or Grammy nomination. Toledo is a wonderful song. You know, you go through it. That's a fabulous album. I agree with you.
Yep. Well, I mean, my introduction to him working with Burt was him doing you put it up on your Instagram recently. The video, was it on Instagram where you put the video up of the sequence from Austin Powers?
Yeah.
Where
they
suddenly just say, oh, you know, he just introduces them, Austin. And,
that's right.
Well, and Heather Graham's character, they just have a dance while Elvis and Burt do a song together. And I just thought, it's amazing. And I think, to take a point that one of your guests has said before, Joe Brand mentioned about people, they said they come out with the same thing as people do about Bob Dylan, a lot about the voice. And and Joe said something about she can't see where that comes from, really, because even more so than Bob, Elvis has got a very expressive voice that is actually in pitch all of the time. He's perfectly in pitch all the time with his voice. So I don't get what the problem is with that voice, really. And when he does little projects like this with Burt, or harmonizing on McCartney songs that is co-written, and he harmonizes perfectly with McCartney, their voices are spot on together. Yeah. And when he sings with these people, it's like, you suddenly think, oh, I never expected that. Or somebody that wouldn't know him would say, oh, well, I don't expect that. I expected him not to be quite so in with this other person. But it always works.
Yeah, I agree. And I love his voice. His voice is one of the things that really got me when I first listened to his music. So Mighty Like a Rose was the first record of Elvis's that I got. And I loved the songs. I thought the songs were great. The arrangements are really interesting on there. There's a real scale of ambition about that record with the production, the arrangements. There are some really big sounds on there. But the thing that links the whole thing is Elvis's singing. And he sings in so many different ways. And you're dead right, Marv. He is so expressive in the way that he sings. He can convey emotions so brilliantly with his voice. And you think about Mighty Like a Rose, you've got songs like Couldn't Call It Unexpected Number 4, which is a beautiful song, which Elvis sings incredibly tenderly. There's a song on there called Broken, where he, I've described this in an article, he's quite blank-eyed the way that he sings that one. It's as though he stripped any emotion out of his voice whatsoever, because he had a song like How to Be Dumb, which is Elvis absolutely eviscerating Bruce Thomas, who used to play bass in The Attractions. And they were, as you know, didn't get on well. So this is after Thomas has left The Attractions. And you can almost hear the spittle on the microphone because Elvis is raging so much in the studio. And that was probably what sealed the deal for me, to be honest, was what a brilliant vocalist he is. And I mean, you mentioned Dylan. I think the same about Dylan. I love Dylan as a vocalist, which, you know, people think is a silly thing to say because, you know, he gets mocked for his voice. But I think he's someone whose voice, as the years have gone on, has got more and more expressive. As he's got older, his voice has dropped. And by the time he's doing stuff like Time Out of Mind, where he is singing, you know, about almost reaching the end of the road, having that voice really, really suits him by that point. And, you know, he's done those Sinatra records where you think it actually works. You know, none of this should work, but it does. And I think there's a charisma to their singing that perhaps more, in inverted commas, technically proficient singers can't capture. You know what I mean? It's the character is there in their voices. Was it Paul Simon, I think, who once said the difference between him and Bob Dylan is that if he sings something, Paul Simon, it means one thing. Whereas if Dylan sings the same line, it could mean a million different things just because of the character in his voice. And I think you get a similar quality with Elvis as well.
I think as a good comparison, it's a bit like, you know, people, if you compare McCartney with Lennon, and Lennon has a more he has a more expressive voice, in a sense. Lennon does, because he's more there's a lot of grit in Lennon's voice, which is the same with Elvis. There's a lot of grit in his voice, whereas McCartney in the Beatles is more of the more of a classic singer vocalist in a sense, and it's the more expressive voices like that have character in them, that Elvis and Bob. It's because of that that their songs have this sort of attraction to them, this difference that normal, dare we say, seasoned what you would call a singer. I don't know really how to explain it, but you know what I mean? Mm. I think their voices put a song across more, which is why there's more of a fanship for them.
Mm, maybe so. I think with McCartney, though, I mean, he's got so many voices, hasn't he? And even in the Beatles days, you think he could switch. I mean, he does on the same record from something like Helter Skelter, where he's really screaming at the top of his range, through to, on the same record, that really fruity voice on Honey Pie, whilst you're taking in the belting voice of Back in the USSR, that gorgeous melodic singing on Blackbird. I think he's a fabulous singer, McCartney. And you were dead right a few minutes ago to pick up on the when he and Elvis sing together, because the demos that they did together for Flowers in the Dirt, and obviously songs that appeared on subsequent records by both of them, it's extraordinary. I mean, I've got the box set down there somewhere, the Flowers one, which is well worth anybody's money. I think if you've got even a passing interest in McCartney or Costello, I think the box set is just wonderful.
Absolutely.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Marv is displaying.
I've got it.
What, £150 worth of glorious McCartney and Costello?
I'm glad the other half can't hear you say
that. Oh, sorry. £25 worth of glorious McCartney and Costello. No, that's wonderful. I must admit, I've not bought all of the McCartney deluxe boxes like that, because some of them I'm a bit more like, I can take or leave that particular record. But Flowers in the Dirt was the first album that I ever owned. And it's the one that's basically, you know, opened a love of music up to me. And ultimately, of course, led me to Elvis and doing the podcast. Because I don't necessarily think I would have got into Elvis had I not had Flowers in the Dirt as my first album. So I got that when I was 10. It was January 1990, and I was visiting my uncle in Australia, and he was the record was about 6 months old at that point, and he just played it all the time while we were there. So I'd never listened to music, to be honest, by that point. The only two things I owned were football-related songs, because I'm a football fanatic. So I had the Liverpool FC's FA Cup final song, the Anfield Rap from 1988.
Yep.
And don't laugh. And at the charity recording of Ferry Cross the Mersey, which Paul McCartney features on, actually, that came out after the Hillsborough disaster as well. They were the only two singles that I owned at that point. So this was the first proper album that I'd got. Became a McCartney fanatic, and then obviously by extension, a Beatles fanatic. And then a couple of years after that, I was sort of on the lookout, you know, for somebody else to get into at that point. So there's nothing more exciting, I don't think, than when you find somebody and then you've got all this music to explore. So I was trying to think who's going to be next. And I went back to the credits on Flowers in the Dirt and thought, oh, Elvis Costello. I know his voice from U1 to 2. I know his name because he co-wrote four other tracks. So I'll give him a try. And as I say, Mighty Like a Rose was the first one. Completely won over by that, and then had a couple of years of buying up his back catalogue. By the time he brought out All This Useless Beauty in 96, I'd pretty much caught up by then, and that was the first record of his that I bought in real time, if you like, when it came out, and obviously I've been well on board of the fan train ever since.
This is Dave of Live Life Loud, the Decibolic Podcast, and you're listening to
Pods Like Us with Marv.
Well, I was going to lean into that, actually, and I don't really need to now, because you've sort of done it, because I was going to ask about how you were introduced to Elvis's music. And it's similar to myself in a sense, but there were certain songs before Flowers in the Dirt, the Paul McCartney album. There were certain songs by Elvis that I'd already heard and I really enjoyed. You know, you get to the classic ones, like, you know, you go to the Oliver's Army, you go to Alison, and you get to go to these songs and Pump It Up and songs like that. But when Flowers in the Dirt came out, the Paul McCartney album, they were the songs that I was drawn to, strangely enough. I don't know why, although saying that, I think my first introduction would have been the single beforehand, because they did the B-side, didn't they? Back on My Feet.
Yeah, which is a great song.
Which is a great song. And then when I heard that, and even though Elvis, does Elvis appear on it? I don't think he performs on it, does he?
He doesn't perform on it. And when you hear the McCartney demo, most of the song is pretty much in place already. And I think it's that sort of the counter melody at the end where there's that sort of whirlwind of words, which is a very Elvis thing to do. But that's a great song, much better than the A-side, which was Once Upon a Long Ago, which I kind of think is a bit, you've got actually a brilliant song on the B-side. Maybe it wouldn't have got as high up the charts as Once Upon a Long Ago did, but I think it's the stronger side of the single, in my opinion.
Yep. And then, those songs that Elvis had co-written and appears on quite a few of them, I was drawn into those, and then so that led me to then thinking, well, what else? Because I was surprised by it. I was one of those people who heard it and thought, wow, he's keeping up here with Macca, and I was just amazed and thought it was fantastic. So from there, I went from there, and obviously when Spike came out, I got that, and I've sort of like bittered and bobbed. My collection isn't very good, I'll be honest. It's not very good of Elvis's albums, but I'm sort of getting there-ish.
Yeah.
We were both sort of introduced essentially to Elvis in a similar way.
Yeah, and that is still one of my favourite albums, Flowers in the Dirt. I know I I ascribe much greater value to it than it probably earns musically, just because of the sort of personal link that I've got to it. And, you know, it was my uncle who introduced it to me, who's not here anymore, and, you know, I thought the world of. And so I have all those associations with it as well. But I do think genuinely on its own merits as a record, it is a terrific album. Probably one of my, definitely one of my top five McCartney solo albums and Wings albums. I don't know what the other four are at this moment in time, but Flowers is going into the top five every time for me.
There you go. If any Beatles podcasters are wanting a guest, bring Stu on and he can do his top five McCartney albums for you.
I will absolutely do that. And also, if anyone's in the market, and this is a very small field, but if anyone is ever in the market for someone to tell you why Press to Play is actually a terrific album, I'm very much your go-to man, because that's another favourite of mine, which I got later, you know, when I was going back and collecting. And wasn't expecting much, Marv, to be honest, because I'd read the reviews of it telling me that it was going to be absolutely dreadful. Got it. I thought, this is really good. So that is... I'm not going to put it in the top five, but it's a top 10 McCartney record for me, definitely.
You know, we're coming out of Elvis Costello here, aren't we?
We are a little bit.
So Press to Play... by Paul McCartney, I put that in a similar vein to McCartney 2, in a sense, where it's Paul experimenting and trying different things.
Yeah.
And even though some people say it's him striving for commercialism, I don't really think it is, because if you were striving for commercialism, you wouldn't have Pretty Little Head on an album, and you certainly wouldn't release it as a single.
Yeah, I was going to say, you might have it on the album. Yeah, you might have it on the album. You don't put it out as a single, do you? No. Well, here's the thing then, Marv, to bring it back to Elvis Costello. And I asked this question in an article that I wrote last year. Do you think that if Press to Play had been much more of a hit and much better received critically, do you think Paul would have taken up his manager's suggestion to write with Elvis when he put it to him in 87?
I really don't know. It's a weird one, because Paul is, as we've said before, Paul is very open to trying things out. He's very experimental, which, you know, I mean, you could prove that with the work that he's done with Fireman, with Youth. So he's always open to that. So in the back of my mind, I'm sort of thinking he might have gone for it just to see where it led. All I know is that I'm really happy that he did, because,
yeah.
But the short period that they were doing the writing, the amount of material that they came out with was astounding.
Mm. And the songs that never made it onto albums as well, things like Tommy's Coming Home, 20 Fine Fingers, things like that. I Don't Want to Confess, which didn't even, to the best of my knowledge, hadn't cropped up anywhere until the reissue in 2017. And you think, wow, these are the songs that didn't make it onto records.
Yep. And a lot of us would be really happy if we could have an album that sounded as good as their demos.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because, you know, no matter how much I like the version on Paul's album of The Lovers That Never Were on the later album,
Off the ground.
I don't think it goes anywhere near the bite and the incredible performance of the demo that they both cut together, which I think I'm right in saying that they said that those demos of just the two of them, I think they were saying that basically they'd done it in a way where they'd done the song, they wrote it, they'd finished it all off, and then they went and recorded it. They're, as Paul says, fresh off the skillet, which to us in the UK, which is a frying pan to us, but it's there fresh, and it's got that sort of freshness that you don't get when you go to record it in a studio later. It's got something that's special to it being fresh.
Yeah, I think that's the track people always go to, isn't it, as being the great example of, oh, it, it didn't improve the more you worked on it. All the magic was there when it was just the two of you together. And Elvis has described that as being one of the highlights of Paul's solo career vocally, the way that he sings on that demo. And Elvis has done a version himself a couple of years ago. He did an EP for Record Store Day, an EP called Purse, which is really good, which is a collection of songs bringing together him and Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, Bacharach and Paul McCartney, and he and the Impostors do a nice version of this version and a couple of demo versions of the two of them together. Yeah, it's a wonderful song.
Yeah, and I like it every time I hear different times that Elvis does the song that they wrote together, That Day Is Done as well. Yeah, I've heard Elvis do that a couple of times and he does a fantastic version of that.
Yeah, he does, yeah. And that one... I'm always interested in how they decided who got which song out of the ones they wrote together, because That Day Is Done, I put in a similar bracket as Veronica in being quite personal to Elvis because he wrote it about his grandmother's funeral. And obviously Paul, as we know from Elvis's book, sort of gave the great sort of release of the chorus in that song. He came up with that, which kind of made the song. But it was interesting that he then cut the main album version of it rather than Elvis, which is interesting. But as you say, Elvis has recorded with the Fairfield Four. He's got a recorded version of it and he's done it live plenty of times over the years as well. That's a great song. And of course, that's the song where we take the title for the Flowers in the Dirt album from as well.
Yep. And I've always wondered all these years who actually came up with that line.
Yeah, it sounds like an Elvis thing, but I'm always reluctant to say that because neither Paul or Elvis are so predictable in that sense. It might well have been Paul who came up with it.
Yeah, because at times Paul can be incredibly poetic in his lyrics and very wordy like Elvis can, but not very often. But they've both got bits that are similar to each other, because sometimes Elvis can be more like Paul with his writing and Paul can be more like Elvis with the writing. And I think that's something that probably attracted each of them to each other from the start, is because they both already had this. You know, despite what people say about Elvis, to bring it back to him, Elvis has an incredible pop sensibility there within his music as well. I think you've mentioned it before when you talked about the early days of Elvis, where he was thrown into tours, doing tours, and it was the punk era of punk, and he was thrown into those, but there was more of a pop edge to Elvis than there was to punk, in my opinion, really. It's got like the grit of punk with a bit of pop in there to give it some, you know, lasting ability in a sense.
Yeah, he's a very well-rounded creative force, isn't he? He can pretty much turn his hand to everything, and you just go through his back catalogue, and if there's something you like in music, Elvis has probably done it at some point. And as you say, he's not afraid to go against the grain. There's the, you know, hilarious line on his covers album, Almost Blue, isn't there, in 1981, when that's an album of country and western covers, and there's a little sort of warning label on it saying, warning, this album contains country and western music, you know, may not be suitable for people who aren't open-minded or whatever the wording is. He's never been afraid to go off the beaten track and do things. And I don't think it's ever contrived. I don't think he's saying, right, Mr. Renaissance man, I'm now going to do this. I think that is just how he feels he can get that music across at that time with that particular batch of songs that he's got. So, no, I think he's a fascinating artist, absolutely fascinating. And as you rightly say, I think that's one of the things that will attract Paul McCartney, Burt Bacharach, all the other people who've worked with him. That's one of the things I imagine that appeals to them about working with Elvis Costello.
Hello, my name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that looks at each Bob Dylan studio recording, funnily enough, album by album. We're going to produce an audio essay or a mini documentary on every single recording, looking at the recording process, also the themes on offer, and the musicality of each record as well. If that sounds like something you might want to listen to, then feel free to check out episode 1. It's on Bob's 26th studio album, Oh Mercy, which is a fascinating record, not only for the music on offer, but also for how it fits into Bob's back catalogue. Have a look at that and let us know your thoughts. If you want to continue the conversation, we're available on Instagram. You can find us at Bob Dylan Podcast, and you can find me on Twitter at Ben Burrell. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
So you've obviously built up a love for Elvis's music over the years. What made you suddenly decide to look into to create this show that looks into everybody, other people's love of Elvis's music and the background of their fanship, for want of a better phrase?
I started the podcast because one didn't exist, basically, because I wanted, as a listener, to have an Elvis Costello podcast where fans of his would get together and talk about his music, what his songs mean to them, and really delve into it, because I enjoy listening to podcasts about other artists. And, you know, I've got loads on my sort of subscribe list about the Beatles and Bob Dylan and all these other people. And I always thought, why is there not one about Elvis Costello? He's someone whose music absolutely stands up to the level of scrutiny that you could get for someone coming on for an hour and talking about what the music means to them. And I know that his fans have a level of devotion to him that would mean if you get them on, they will happily talk and talk and talk about it. So I desperately wanted to listen to a show like that, and one didn't exist. And then I bemoaned that for a while. And then at some point I thought, actually, I could do this. Could I? Because my background's in radio. I'm a broadcaster. I thought, well, I know how to do a podcast. I've got all the, sounds big-headed, but I know how to do it in terms of skills and everything. I've got all the equipment that I need to do it for my radio work, and I'm an Elvis fan, so I've kind of got all the things in place there to do it. I then had that thing that I'm sure lots of people listening who have got podcasts have probably had at some point. I don't know if you did as well, Marv, where you think, am I the right person to do this? Should I do it? You know, you have that little moment of doubt before you go for it. So I mulled it over for a little while. And then one day I just thought, you know what, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to give this a try. Because I'd already developed in my head what I thought a good format would be, which is what we were talking about before with the playlist. So I thought, well, I'll go for it and I'll throw out to my first guests and see if there's any interest in it. And that's the bit where it could potentially have fallen apart at that stage, really. If no one had come back to me, then it wouldn't have gone anywhere. But the first person I approached was Mark Billingham, the crime writer and actor, who's a huge Elvis Costello fan. Yeah. And I sent off an email to him. I didn't know him. I just sort of went through his sort of contact on his website, told him what I was planning to do, and sent it off, not knowing if I'd ever hear anything back. You know, I thought that might be the end of it. There might be like one of those, missile tests that just explodes on the launch pad and we never go any further. But I'm not joking. Mark came back within about half an hour saying, I would absolutely love to do this. Just tell me where and when you want to do it. And I thought, wow, right, okay, I'm going to have to do it now because I've told Mark I'm going to do it. And of course, once you've got one guest signed up, that means then when you approach guest number two, you can say, I've got best-selling author Mark Billingham as my first guest. Would you like to be the second? And the take-up was ace, actually, Marv. I was really pleasantly surprised, because you never know, do you? I mean, I was approaching people who don't know me, and I'm selling to them a podcast that doesn't yet exist. So I thought there could be people who either say no or just don't respond whatsoever. But I was getting such a hit rate out of it that I thought, wow, this is actually going to happen. And one thing I wanted to do was to know that I could do 8 episodes before I started and before I launched. Because what I didn't want to do is get 1 or 2 episodes out there and then it all dries up and I'm struggling to get anyone else in. I thought, if I can have 8 episodes all recorded and ready to go, then even if it falls apart after 8 episodes, I know I will have done like a mini season that is there for people to go and explore. But hopefully it will be the first 8 of many to follow. And that's the way that it's proven to be. That was 2020 when we launched. And still going strong, still enjoying it, which is one of the main things, as you well know, Marv, when you're putting a show together, you've got to enjoy doing it.
Absolutely. And the thing is, though, I mean, Elvis is one of those characters. I mean, we've sort of mentioned it already, this. Elvis is one of those people where it's like the Bob Dylan thing, where if it's an artist that hits you, then it's an artist that hits you. And you know what it's like when you're with people that have a similar love for an artist, you can talk for absolutely ages about it, no matter who you are, whether you're somebody who's, you know, like Joe Brand, who does comedy and is on the television, or this person that's that, or this person who's just, you know, a bin man, but he loves Elvis Costello. All those people will talk about that in a similar fashion anyway, because it hits that these people in a certain way. To give a bit of a story or a background to this, I was supposed to be doing a piece for a local newspaper at one point. And they had Tony Wright from who was he from? Flipping it, from Terror Vision, the lead singer of Terror Vision, was doing a gig.
Okay, yeah,
he was doing a gig in Mansfield, Nottinghamshire, at the Town Mill. Yeah. Rest in peace, missed that place. And I was assigned to supposedly do an interview with him about, you know, where he is, about his band at the time, Like a Dog, which was his outside project, or his side project. And I got the, you know, back in the day, I got the dictaphone out, got it recording, were there chatting away. And by the time we'd finished, I'd actually not done anything at all for the piece that I was supposed to be writing. And all we talked about was, I think the only thing we touched of it was, you know, his favourite album of Terror Visions, and, you know, and I think we did one or two more.
Right. But
all we ended up talking about was the fact that we had a mutual love of the Beatles. He suddenly went into like the Beatles White Album.
Right.
And this sort of era of the Beatles. And we went down there, and about 45 minutes to an hour later, it's like, oh crap, we've run out of time. All we've spoken about is the Beatles.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure that there's always a place for it, though, isn't there? When you get someone talking passionately about something they love, you can always use that somewhere, can't you?
That's so true. Lessons learned. Don't send a musician to talk to another musician to do an interview.
Yeah.
But I mean, were you already listening to podcasts before? What sort of podcasts were you listening to before then that you took inspiration from for your own?
My favourite podcast, music-wise, is Take It Away, the Paul McCartney Archive podcast, which I think is brilliant. And I had the great pleasure of having Chris Mercer, one of the hosts, as a guest on my show as well, because he's a huge Elvis Costello fan as well as being a big Paul McCartney fan. So that was really great to have Chris on. And he brought a really interesting perspective, because he's a composer and he teaches composition to students as well. So we had a very interesting insight into the way that Elvis composes his music. And so just for me personally, it was a bit of a buzz to have Chris on, because I admire him and his show so much as well. So that was probably my favourite music podcast. And the one, more than any other, that gave me, you know, sort of creative ideas about how I might go about doing an Elvis Costello one, not and think, right, well, how would I do it to that quality, but in a different way and about a different subject? So I mean, I listen to lots of them, really, but that's always been my favourite music one. I'm just a bit sad now that they've kind of got to the end of Macca's albums, although if you do listen to my episode with Chris, he does tease at the end of it that he's working on one or two other things for Take It Away as well. So watch that space and we may get a little bit more. But I've been a big podcast listener for a long time, Marv, really. I was quite an early adopter, actually. I think mainly because of being a broadcaster, I've always been interested in audio and the way of delivering audio to audiences. And so when I started working in radio, that was, you know, completely 100% live broadcasting. But yep. I can remember maybe around the mid-2000s, there started to be the first signs of a shift towards on-demand audio. And one of the first big projects I worked on was for the 2006 World Cup finals, football or soccer for your listeners elsewhere. And I was coordinating this project whereby we would supply audio to about 20 radio stations around the UK, and that would be available to their listeners on demand. It would be placed on their website and they would go on and listen to it whenever they wanted to listen to it. And that was probably the first big occasion where I thought, oh right, okay, that's probably where we're going to go increasingly now as a medium. And obviously podcasts are the natural extension of that, aren't they? So I think probably one of the first ones I listened to might have been from the Word magazine, because I know they were doing it very, very early on. David Hepworth, Mark Ellen, who else do you have? Andrew Harrison in those early days as well. That was a really good listen. And then obviously the iPhone came out not long after, which suddenly then makes it even more accessible for people to listen to podcasts. So yeah, I've been a massive podcast fan for a long time. And, you know, I must confess, even though I'm a radio man, I listen to less and less live radio now. And I will increasingly turn to stuff that I've downloaded and saved on my phone, to be honest.
Well, it's natural. I mean, the whole world seems to be going that way with media anyway, where everybody's yeah. doing on demand. So, you know, because more people will sign up to Netflix and all these other things for watching things on television than they will watch actual appointment television, as it's called. And the same thing goes for radio, where it took a lot of radio stations a long time to actually provide a service as good as they've got now, where people will listen to radio shows when it suits them now, as opposed to thinking, oh, I've got to listen to, I don't know, you know, I've got to listen to Ken Bruce at this time in the morning for Popmaster. And now, well, you don't need to, because it's got its own mini podcast now.
Absolutely.
And so occasionally I will put the radio on in the background for a bit of just something that's going on, but if I really want to get into a certain show, that is how I do it. I do it when I've got the time to be able to fit it in, and then I listen to it, and that's done by on demand or podcast, as it's called generically.
I'm the same. And I think, you know, the industry looks radically different to how it was when I started in 2000. And as you say, some have taken a little bit longer than others to catch on. I think that there is still a role for live broadcasting. I mean, I do a lot of sports commentating and football reporting, things like that. There's something that you can't replicate in any other way than doing it live. And it's probably one of the few ways that you have appointment to listen broadcasting now, isn't it? But you're dead right about the TV as well, because I can't think what the show was, Marv, but there was one a year or so ago, one of the big dramas on one of the terrestrial channels, where they were putting it out at a set time. You know, it was 9 o'clock Sunday to watch it. And because our habits have changed so much, my wife and I would watch it, and then it's like, all right, should we download the next one? Oh no, we can't. We've got to wait 7 days to watch the next episode. How prehistoric is this? But you know, that's where we are. And I think you embrace it, don't you? I think it's all about convenience for the consumer of the media.
We're going on a tangent here, but when I was talking with somebody about that exact thing, we were talking about how there's a lot of streamers will do, like you say, they'll have one thing and they'll put the whole season out as a whole, you know, in one go, like a clump. There you go. You can watch them all off you go. But and then at the other, from the other angle, you've got these other streamers now who are back to doing the old-fashioned thing of releasing one every week or one every so often as this thing. And I was saying to these people that the problem is, you know, that when you have shows that, I think it's what works for, bringing it back to podcast, I think it's what works for podcast in a way, is that, you know, myself and yourself, we pre-record our shows in advance most of the time. If we did it where we recorded our entire podcast series or season in a clump and then we just said, here you go, there's the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's sort of not got the longevity in a sense, because it's almost like you see it on, it used to happen back in the day when you had programs on television like Lost, where people would watch it and then they'd respond week to week.
Yes. Yeah,
and it has a build up from week to week. And I saw that with recently with the Mandalorian series, where that had the same thing, where that was being released. And then each week you'd have some response online. And I think that's how you build up a following. Whereas if you put things out in a clump, if you did a documentary series, or a friend of mine, and I think you know him as well, Ben Burrow, when he does the Bob Dylan album by album series, which is all pre-recorded earlier, I don't think that would have the same response from the listeners if he just put it all out in one go. Whereas week to week, I think it works better.
Yeah, and you're right. You certainly get that response a little bit more, don't you? You put out this episode and you get a lot of feedback about this particular episode. But even in doing that, you will get this as well, I'm sure. Things will bubble up from time to time where I'll suddenly see a spike, no pun intended with Elvis, yeah, a spike in listeners for some episode from a while ago. And you always think, I wonder why so many people at this particular time a year later have gone to that particular episode now. Or, you know, you'll see someone suddenly liked something in your social media feed from 18 months ago or something, and you think, oh, it's great that, but I wonder how they arrived at that particular episode or that post at that particular point in time. But hey, as long as they listen, that's the main thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's strange that, you know, you'll look and you'll look at your statistics. I mean, you shouldn't really look at your statistics, because sometimes it brings you down a bit because you think you're doing better than you are. And you look at the statistics of your show and then you think, you see the episodes that they're watching and you think, you know, if you see a certain period of the show where they've listened to them in succession, basically, you see one over a period of a couple of days, your first six episodes or seven episodes have been listened to at least once or maybe twice or whatever, you think that's obviously somebody who's going from the beginning and working the way. But when you see them suddenly with me, where I've got nearly 100 shows coming out, and then suddenly I'll think, hold on a minute, why has somebody suddenly listened to episode 27?
Yeah.
Why have I suddenly got a spike on that, where so many people have listened to that from a couple of years ago? And it's strange, but I think it's also to do with what subject you're discussing sometimes. So I'm guessing that when you've had certain guests, they have a larger spike of listeners than some others.
Yeah, that's right. I won't say who, because it's unfair on others, but it's interesting, really interesting. But as I say, you know, it's always nice when you get a message saying, I've just discovered the podcast, and, you know, someone is starting the journey from episode one again and is catching up. It's nice to think that that's happening all the time, isn't it? That there is always someone finding you from somewhere and having a listen. So, yeah, we'll take them however they find us.
Absolutely.
Hey, this is Brian with Concerts That Made Us podcast, and you're listening to Pods Like Us, a great show about other great shows.
So when you're leading up to doing the shows, how do you arrange the guest? And then I'm guessing that you must do extensive research on the guest as well, so that it flows better as a show, so you know who you're talking to, you know about them, and you know what points to hit.
Yeah, absolutely. For bringing the guests on board, that's slightly evolved as the show's become more and more established. As I mentioned before, when I was approaching people like Mark Billingham. For that season one, I was essentially cold calling people. The guests I'm looking for notable guests who I know have got an interest in Elvis Costello. So we're, you know, I've got musicians, broadcasters, authors, politicians. We've had quite a range of people who've come on who I know to be fans of Elvis Costello for one reason or another. So season one, I was basically cold calling, you know, going on to people's websites and finding the contact form, or if they had messages open on their socials, I'd drop them a message. And as I said before, it was a little bit of a hard sell. It's like, hi, I'm someone you don't know, trying to get you onto a podcast that doesn't exist. Would you fancy it? Unfortunately, you know, eight people said yes for that first season and did it. Since it's launched, that's changed slightly because obviously I can now contact people and point them towards my back catalogue and the website that I've got. So they know exactly what it's all about before they choose to respond. I've also now, which is really satisfying, get people approaching me about coming on, which is good. You know, people who've heard it and say, oh, I'd love to do that. Could I? Or people will recommend other people to me as well, which is really nice. So guests will come on and say, you know who you should speak to. They'll give me a contact number for somebody else. So it kind of self-perpetuates now and has sort of taken on a bit of a life of its own, which is good. I still do throw out the odd message to someone who I don't have a contact with and take it from there. But it is nice that it's starting to generate guests in its own way. And then research-wise, yeah, you're right. I make sure I know everything I need to know about the guest, and particularly if they've got a link with Elvis, because a lot of the people who've been on have either worked with him musically or they've interviewed him or they've recorded with him for some other project. So I need to make sure I know all the things I need to know about that relationship that they've got with him. And then we talked earlier about the fact I ask each guest to give me half a dozen songs, one from each decade. And then I do a little bit of research on each song as well. Obviously, I will know the songs through being an Elvis fan, but I'm looking for a bit of colour and context that I can add to the conversation. So I'm always looking for, first of all, the facts and figures about it, who plays on it, where was it recorded, where it was released, any chart figures and things like that. And then looking for anything Elvis has said about the song over the years. So I'll be flicking into, you can see on my shelves behind me, there's a few Elvis books on there as well. So I'll be leafing through trying to find if Elvis has said stuff. And I'm a big hoarder of a lot of the monthly music magazines as well. So, you know, I was a massive Q and Mojo reader, particularly back in the day. And I've kept all of that. So I'll be leafing through trying to find some quotes that Elvis might have come up with. And then I'm looking for things that other people have said about the songs as well. So reviews, things that maybe people who've appeared on it, you know, as Paul McCartney said anything about that song they wrote together? Did Burt Bacharach say anything? And I'll just, without overloading the listener with lots of facts and figures, I'll just try and provide a little bit of context and colour for those songs as well. And, you know, what's really pleasing is a lot of my guests have done a lot of homework as well when they come on, and, you know, they've made notes just to kind of order their thoughts as well and just to give them a little aid memoir as we're going through the conversation as well. So, yeah, a bit of work goes into researching each episode, but it's not really work, is it? It's just, you know, it's just putting together bits of info about someone whose music I really enjoy. So it's good fun.
Well, some of your guests, I mean, they'd fit perfectly with that anyway, because I mean, like when you had David Quantick on, for instance, I mean, yeah, he's from that world of music journalism anyway. I mean, he's somebody who I used to read a lot of his writing in Q magazine and things like that. So, I mean, I would have thought that he would naturally have done that anyway on the lead up to the show. He would have taken extensive notes anyway, because he's from that world of journalism anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure he did make extensive notes, because I think when we came to record, he'd forgotten which songs he'd actually picked for the playlist, David. So I had to give him a nudge on those, but he then could instantly recall everything that he wanted to say about those songs. Funnily enough, he was, I think, David was the quickest to respond with the song choices out of any guest that I've ever had, because some people, when they've agreed to come on and we're kind of sorting out dates to record and everything, and some of them might then take a couple of weeks, because I appreciate it's a pretty difficult question to try and narrow their love of Elvis down to one song per decade. I do always give them the get out, the caveat that it's not necessarily their favourite song of that decade, but it's a song that they love from that decade. So some people have taken a couple of weeks to decide what they wanted to do. When I was emailing back and forth with David Quantic, I told him what the format needed to be, and he came back about 20 minutes later with all the songs that he was going to talk about. So wow. Yeah, some people just give it to you like that. And as he said on the show, when I asked him about that, he said, well, you know what you like, don't you? And yeah, he was great. He was really good fun to have on, David, actually, for all the reasons you said. I've read loads of stuff because he's written for publications that I really enjoy. And he's a good example of where people have a particular insight into different aspects of Elvis's career. Every episode is different because it's that individual guest's own experience with Elvis. But what has happened in the more natural and organic way is that they also bring a level of expertise about one area. So with David, for instance, being a great screenwriter, I thought, oh, well, he's a person to ask about some of Elvis's acting roles that he's done over the years. When I had Boyd Hilton on, who's a great entertainment journalist with Empire and Heat magazine, and he's a great TV reviewer, right, he's the man that I should spend a few minutes talking about Spectacle, Elvis's television show. So everyone has just kind of brought a slightly different aspect to it as well as then talking about the five different songs, or six different songs as it is from this season, as we go forward.
So when you do each season, though, I mean, you know, this is another tangent. When you do each season, then, do you base your guest and try to make them as varied as you can then from different walks of life? I mean, of course, they've got this sort of level where they are celebrity, for want of a different phrase, in a sense, or that. But so are you purposely picking somebody who has this, as this sort of different viewpoint of Elvis, then, where you've got Jo Brand has this history with Elvis, where she was on this with him, or this person will look more at his career from this angle, or this person. Do you actually shape the season to be like that?
I would like to, and that would make it sound like there's a sort of grander plan in place than there actually is. To be honest, Marv, a lot of it comes down, as you know, from when you're putting your show together, who's available when is a big bit. So, you know, there are some people who've come on, but they may not have been able to do it for X number of months because of projects they're working on or something. Even though they agree to it in March, I might not be able to do it until September. The show might not go out until later on, etc. So it's really not quite like that, even though it would make sense to do it like that. And if it appears that way, then that's slightly more by accident than design, but accidents will happen, won't they? So
that's brilliant. You got one of his songs in there, that's great. So how do you record and edit the show then?
The vast majority of my shows, I've recorded the interviews remotely, which is not what I wanted to do when I set out with the podcast. But unfortunately, I was putting this idea together probably late 2019 into early 2020. And of course, come March, everything changes and we're locked down with restrictions and so on. So it became by circumstance more of a remote thing. I did get a chance to record a couple of episodes in person, with guests who are local to me in Liverpool, who we, under the restrictions at the time, we were able to get together and elbow bump one another and sit a couple of meters apart with long leads and do it in person. So I got a couple of episodes done in person. And for that setup, I've got just a nice little portable recording device, a couple of good quality Rode microphones plugged in and recorded onto my SD card, and edit on my laptop or my PC later on. For the majority of them, it's been remote which has been used in Zoom, I think, in every case. I've got a nice bit of kit called a Pod Track. I don't know if you've used one of those, which is the four-track mixer and recorder, which is a really nice piece of equipment. So that records our two ends of the conversation onto separate channels, which is really helpful for the editing process. Again, I record my side on a Rode microphone, and another channel will take in the guests' feed separately. It keeps them synchronized, but gives you them as separate channels, which is really helpful for when you come to tidy things up in the edit. If my guest has got a microphone, that is so much better for me, for them at their end. Not the end of the world if they don't. And then my absolute dream scenario is if my guest is able to record their side of the conversation locally, and then, you know, we transfer me across the audio file at the end, just so we're keeping really good sound quality at both sides. And then editing wise, I use Adobe Audition, which is a really nice piece of software, something I've used for a little while in different roles that I've had. And that's what I've used for all of the episodes of the podcast. And then my host is Anchor, which I did basically because there was no charge attached to it. And I was also familiar with it from another project I'd worked on. So yeah, I'm pretty happy with the setup I've had so far. As I say, I would like to have done more of it in person. And that is what I set out with the intention of doing. But actually, as time's gone on, this has just become the accepted way of doing things now, hasn't it? And as I've got increasingly more and more overseas guests coming on, obviously doing it remotely would be the only way we could have done that. So, yeah, that's how it's gone. And I'm pretty happy with the setup so far.
Not that you should really say that there's a positive out of the whole COVID thing, but I would say that there's a positive in a sense that because of the lockdown, I think it made a lot of these people more approachable and easy to get hold of, in a sense.
Yeah.
And
it's strange because more time on the hands.
More time on the hands. But also the fact that, you know, before COVID, it wasn't such a thing that was done so often. But now, you know, I mean, we're not completely out of it, really. But now, even though we're sort of almost out of it all, and we're back to a semblance of normality, it's become the norm now for people to do this sort of thing. You'll find it on radio shows now where they'll do it this way more often, and they'll stay at home and do the interview from home rather than coming to the radio station, which is probably a better thing, really, because not wanting to give anything away too much, but radio studios are incredibly small and tight spaces, people. I'll just put that out there from someone who's been in a radio station and done things in there. But so it's become the norm, really.
It has, yeah. And I think back a couple of years to when I was planning it all, I was prepared to get in my car and drive a couple of hours for each episode and record it all in person, then drive home and the edit. And now I think about it, it was like, God, when was I going to squeeze that into my life, you know, along with other work commitments, along with things I like to do socially and everything? Where would I have found time to do that? And as you say, I think technology has caught up, hasn't it? And, you know, necessity is always the mother of invention, isn't it? And although Zoom and other platforms existed before, I think the need to have it as good as possible during lockdown has meant that we now have such good software that we can use to do it. So I don't know if we'll go back. The other interesting thing as well, from a broadcasting point of view, Marv, is that I think people have become a lot more forgiving around audio quality as well. See, I'm incredibly pedantic about audio, but being of a radio background, and you with your musician's hat on will have this as well. You want pristine studio quality sound at all times. And, you know, I'd really not happy if it's not that. But I can remember one of my friends saying to me, people are not that bothered, particularly with COVID and the way that they were getting their media during COVID, which, as you say, is people on the phones, it's people on the laptops doing things like this. And it's not always in the kind of quality that this conversation is, but people have just become forgiving. And I think it's really adjusted people's expectations of what to expect. And it's taken me a little while as a radiophile to, you know, to get on board with that. But that's pretty much how it is, I think.
Think some albums are too long? Us too. Don't worry. we can do something about it. Join us as we critique albums from artists we love and edit them down to under 50 minutes. Can we make a good album a great one? Can we make an average album a good one? What songs will we pick? What will we drop? Will we include B-sides? Will we lose some album tracks? Join us and our guests as we take the journey to trim the musical fat.
Okay, I'm now going to touch on another subject that I really love about your show, which is the theme music. I think that's fantastic. I mean, is that actually somebody doing versions of Elvis's songs, or have you got actual Elvis tracks that you've pulled bits from?
No, they are recorded specially for the show. I did look into, I spoke to a couple of publishing organisations about using some of Elvis's own recordings, and let's just say my budget for the show would not stretch that far to use it for those purposes, so that was a no-no. And the theme music was recorded specially for the show by an old schoolmate of mine, Gary Mulcahy, who's a brilliant musician and multi-instrumentalist. And this also goes back to COVID as well, because do you remember during that first lockdown in the UK, everyone's finding hobbies, aren't they? Everyone was baking banana bread or sourdough and things like that. And I think Gary's thing was to get himself into his home studio and record tracks that he then was sharing on his social media. So he was doing his own music, but also his performances of other people's songs, and he'd post them up. And I was enjoying listening to them. And as I was starting to put the podcast together, I got in touch with him and I said, have you recorded any Elvis Costello songs? Explained that I was putting this podcast together and sort of saying, if you've done an Elvis one, could we reach an agreement for me to use it as the theme song? And he said, well, I'd love to record something especially for you, which brilliant for me to hear. So I think he had a couple of days in his studio playing around with different ideas. I gave him free rein on it. I was so grateful that a proper musician was going to do something for me that I'm like, yeah, you, whatever you think, you just go with. The only two stipulations I gave were the length that I needed, because I'd scripted what my intro was going to be, so I knew how long the music had to be. And the other thing that I stipulated was that I wanted a definitive end into the intro as well. I didn't want a slow fade. I needed like a crashing chord at the end that I could then pick up off the back of to start talking to my guests. They were the only two things that I gave him as guidance. So he went away, had a bit of fun for a couple of days playing around with things, and he came up with this, which is a medley of his interpretations of Veronica, Pump It Up, and Oliver's Army, which I'm so pleased with. And he did me a few stings as well that I can play in, you know, just to punctuate the show, beginning, middle, and end, which work brilliantly. And I'm glad you like it, Marv. I love it. And I'm so pleased that I've got it, because the music is the one bit of the whole enterprise that I couldn't do myself. I'm not a musician. You know, I could clunk my three chords that I can manage on a piano, but it wouldn't make a great intro to a podcast. Every other element of it, I could either do well or I could fudge. But the music was something that I just couldn't, I couldn't do myself. So, I'm made up with it. And I think it gives it a really nice distinctive character. And obviously now we're a few seasons in, I think it's really settled and is quite familiar when people tune into the podcast. I really like it. Glad to hear from you as a musician, Marv, that you're enjoying it as well.
I do, and I'm really happy that it's picked those three as well, because they're three of my faves, really. And I think it's picked three that you hear those, and whether you're somebody who just knows Elvis's music slightly, you would know what they are. You hear it and instantly, I know that's Veronica, I know that's Oliver's Army, I know that's Pump It Up, because they are the ones that people know. And I also love the show logo as well. I mean, that's obviously Elvis to a T, even though my interpretation of the picture is dreadful.
Well, on your interpretation, it's slightly more of a 10-gallon hat, I think, isn't it?
It is,
The Elvis version.
If anyone sees the video, there you go. That's my terrible picture. There you go.
Yeah.
But that was another... I do notes. There you go.
You do notes, yeah. That was another mate of mine did that. Another mate called Gary, actually, McGillivray. Okay. You don't have to be called Gary to work on the podcast, but it helps. And he's a brilliant graphic designer who I've worked with for a long time. And I mean, I could have fudged the artwork. I could have come up with something, you know, on one of the packages you can get on your laptop, but it wouldn't have been very good. So I approached Gary about doing this. Now, he's not a fanatic of Elvis Costello, but he's very familiar with him and his music. So he had enough of an insight, as well as the briefing that I gave him, to come up with something really good. And I had in my head, I wanted a silhouette of the hat at an angle, and then the glasses, because as you say, Marv, to me, that is instantly recognizable as being Elvis Costello. So I asked him if he'd come up with something along those lines. And you know what graphic designers are like? He not only came up with a couple of ideas on that, he came up with another half dozen concepts.
Yep.
Sent me, I can remember getting the email through and just like flicking over page to page. I was like, wow, I would take any of these designs. They were all fantastic, all very different. But I couldn't get away from the idea of the silhouette of the hat and glasses. So we've done a couple of variations of it. And the one I've gone for, if people haven't seen it, it's very dark and there's a spotlight or a searchlight around Elvis's hat and glasses. And it's got quite a noir quality to it. And I thought, yep, that fits in really well with the darkness of some of Elvis's lyrics. And the searchlight for me almost subconsciously puts you in mind of watching the detectives as well. But the main thrust of it is the hat and the glasses. And again, I agree with you. To me, you see that and you just think that's Elvis Costello. And when I see it on the podcast app alongside other logos, I'm dead chuffed with it because I think it looks really good. And I think he's done a brilliant job for me. So yeah, I'm lucky to have mates who are very talented in areas in which I do not have anything like that level of talent and would not have been able to come up with a logo or a theme tune as good as they have for me.
Yep. Right, where are we going? Hold on. And there you go. Can you see that? There you go. There is your logo. Is that showing up on your screen? There you go. Like you said, that says it all. There you go. This is me trying to use Zoom to share a screen.
Although I did still feel the need to put that secondary line on it, conversations about Costello, just in case it wasn't obvious. But yeah, that says Elvis to me, I think, when I see it.
So what would you say would be a good start for anybody that's starting with the music of Elvis? I mean, which is a difficult question considering what he's done in the different, dare we say, genres that he's gone into. What would you say, actually, give a list of things where you think that people could start from if they wanted to get into Elvis's music?
I'm glad you phrased the question in that way, because if you'd have asked me what's my favourite or what's his best, that's such an impossible question to answer. But giving people ways in is a good question. I think you'd go to This Year's Model in 1978, the first record he recorded with The Attractions. It's brilliant. I mean, it's just brilliant. You can analyse it in better musicologist terms than that, but essentially it's brilliant. Every track is terrific on that. They play brilliantly, The Attractions. It's Elvis, Steve Naive on keyboards, Pete Thomas on drums, Bruce Thomas on bass, and they are brilliant. It's a powerhouse of a band. There's a real electricity to their performances. The songs are brilliant. I mean, people, even if you're not a big Elvis fan, you will know some of the songs on this record. Pump It Up's on there. I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea is on there. Lipstick Vogue is on there. Some of the real bedrock songs of Elvis and The Attractions. I think it's superb. And yeah, that if I had to say to somebody who didn't know Elvis, here's one record that I think will make you an Elvis fan, that is the one that I would give to them, because it sums up what Elvis was about in that early career-defining period. He, as you rightly say, has gone on to do so many other different things that don't sound anything like This Year's Model, but that is where it all started, and I think it's a brilliant record. And you mentioned Jeremy Vine earlier, who's one of my guests on the show. I think he's mentioned elsewhere that he thinks This Year's Model is the greatest rock and roll album ever made. So There you go. People can debate that if they wish, but it's definitely in the conversation for that title, I think.
I think it was. It's an interesting album where you've got a group there that they know how to play. I mean, there's a I touched on it earlier when I felt that it was slightly wrong when he was, placed into. When he started, there was the punk movement going on, and he was sort of placed almost into that. And I always thought there was more of a musicality to Elvis's music, and there's more melodicism in Elvis's music, absolutely. And on that album, this year's model, you've got the music is much more intricate, and there's a lot. It's a lot more complex than people really think that it is. There's a lot going on in there, chord wise, and melodically as well, where he's going all over the place on the whole album. And Steve Naive's keyboard work is legendary, and it starts from there. You've got, he's there straight away, and I'm not going to say that Steve didn't get better as time goes on, but I'm going to say that Steve's playing is solid from the word go, from there onwards. And the same goes for Bruce and for Pete. Their rhythm work is incredible as well, and backs up what Steve and Elvis are doing at the front. So you've got musicians there that are doing things that with the album before, the previous album that Elvis had done before, he'd got the Attractions. He got all these people doing the instrumentation around him, and it's almost as though he sort of like pulled back on the instrumentation, on how many people were playing. But those songs on that album have got just as much going for them, and there's just as much going on there with four of them playing for the most part live together. For the guide tracks, most of the instrumentation on that album, this year's model, is there in that place live, and there's nothing else added to it. Whereas beforehand, you've got all this production going on and people coming in, and it's layered. But you didn't need the layering on the second album, because what they're playing is texturally equal to what was on that layered, produced album that came beforehand.
Yeah, and you're right. They had such an interesting dynamic as a band, because Steve is this incredible keyboard player and Bruce is such a melodic bass player. And they almost reverse roles a little bit, Elvis and Bruce, in that Elvis almost becomes the rhythm section with Pete playing his guitar and allowing Bruce to do all the flourishes that in other groups, the guitar work might be the flourish. But here it's the bass player and the keyboard player. And then you've got Elvis driving the song on his guitar. And then at the back of it all, the man that he describes as the greatest rock and roll drummer in the world, Pete Thomas. There's a real dynamic about them that is so fascinating to see. And of course, then, they had their sort of personal animosities within the group, particularly between Elvis and Bruce, which if you read accounts of how they come to do Blood and Chocolate in 86, for instance, a lot of the feeling on that record, which is incredibly edgy in places and angry, a lot of that comes through in the music, because there's so much resentment in the room from at least Bruce and possibly the other two Attractions towards Elvis as well. So I think both musically and personally, the dynamic within the Attractions is really interesting. And there's that marked difference, as you rightly say, from My Aim Is True, which he records with Clover, who go on to be the backing band for Huey Lewis. Yep. There's the very sort of West Coast sound about that record, isn't there? It sounds quite American and laid back in some places. And then when you get to this year's model, which is only the next calendar year, it's like an out-of-control freight train, isn't it? They're going 100 miles an hour, but without losing any of the melodicism, as you say, that they're capable of producing. And I think it's that musicality that sets them apart from punk, isn't it? Because, one of the whole ethoses of punk was that, people weren't virtuosos on their instruments. Now, Elvis isn't a virtuoso, but Steve is and Bruce is. I think they always had a little bit more about them than their contemporaries.
Yep. And Pete was always much more than just the drummer. There was always something special about his playing as well that was not like the punk drummers that were going on. There was more of a feel, groove, and expression in his playing. It wasn't just all out like a lot of punk bands. His playing on drums was expressive.
Yeah, he's a great drummer. I mean, I'm not musically knowledgeable enough to go into the intricacies of why he's a great drummer, but the feel that he gets on his songs is terrific. And only recently Elvis has said that since the death of Charlie Watts, that has elevated Pete in the pantheon to being the greatest rock and roll drummer of all time. If he's good enough for Elvis, he's good enough for me. That's all we can say.
Yeah. And in passing, Paul McCartney has always had, back in the day, he used to actually say about Bruce that he was a fan of Bruce's bass playing, which is why Bruce is the only person outside of the Wings members to have actually played bass on Beatles song. So there you go. Because he's the bass player, he's the main bass player, bassist, isn't he, on the Rockestra theme and So Glad to See You here on the Back to the Egg album, I think.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And in his book, Rough Notes, he recounts... forgive me, I can't quite remember the whole story, but he's talking about speaking to Paul at Abbey Road. And I think he says something like, sorry for pinching, you know, or copying a bass part of yours. And he said that Paul gets his bass and starts playing the bass part to I Don't Want to Go to Chelsea, which Bruce plays on Elvis's record as well. So there's very much a meeting of minds there between the melodic bass players.
Absolutely.
Hey there, this is Bobby with the Rock Guys Podcast, and you are listening to Marv Smooth on the Pods Like Us podcast. Check him out.
So what advice would you give to people if they were starting their own podcast?
I think people should find something they're interested in and passionate about, and also find a niche in the market as well. As I said at the start, that was one of the things I did with this show, is that there wasn't an Elvis Costello podcast where fans got together to talk about his music, so I made one. So always try and find something that isn't available elsewhere. You could be the 200,000th Beatles podcast, but it's like, well, what are you talking about that the other 200,000 aren't talking about? So you've got to, even if it's a subject about which there are loads of podcasts, try and find a different angle. I mean, one of your former guests is a really good example of that, when you had Joe from the Beatles Books podcast. It's like, okay, there are millions of Beatles podcasts, but here's one that looks specifically and talks specifically to the authors of books about the Beatles, which is that's a really interesting angle to take on it. And that's a really good show. I really enjoy listening to that. Find an angle, find a little niche for yourself, and just make sure it's something that you enjoy doing. Because as you know, Marv, it's fun to do, but it takes up a lot of your time, you know, organizing episodes, recording, editing, all of the socials that you want to do around it to promote it. It does take time. It does eat into your calendar. So if you're going to do that, you've got to make sure it's about something that you're passionate about.
Absolutely. So what shows do you actually like listening to yourself?
My favourite podcast, number one, is Quickly Kevin Willie Score, which is a 90s football podcast by Josh Widdicombe, Chris Skull, and Michael Marden, which is brilliant. It combines two of my favourite things, which are football and the 1990s. So it is very much in my wheelhouse. It's very funny. They have brilliant guests on there. And it's one of those where all of the reference points are just completely up my street. Being of a similar age to the hosts, the things they refer to are things that remind me of being a teenager in the 90s. So that's a good one. And then they did a lot of good live shows on Zoom during COVID. So I would go to all of those, and they've done live shows as well. Unfortunately, personal circumstance meant I had to give my ticket to somebody a couple of months ago when they were doing a live show. So I'm hoping they will come back round again. I think that's a terrific show. Another good football-related one, football and music-related, is Life Goals with Theo Delaney. And Theo has been a guest on Dangerous Amusements because he's a mad Elvis Costello fan. In fact, he's the only person who's appeared on the show twice, because he came back to do a bonus episode with me. But that show is terrific. And I've told Theo himself that I'm incredibly jealous that he's done that show, because I think it's a brilliant format and I wish I'd come up with the idea first. It's basically a spin on Desert Island Discs, but the guest picks 8 goals from football matches that have meant a lot to them in their life, and then a corresponding piece of music that goes along with it. So that's a terrific format. Desperately wish I'd come up with it, but Theo does it brilliantly. You mentioned Take It Away. That's probably my favourite music podcast. I really enjoy Pop Collaborate and Listen, which, again, I slightly wish I'd come up with that idea. And it's two guys, Dave and Krista, who review every single UK number one album of the 90s, which is a massive undertaking because it's one album per episode. So at the time that we're recording this, they're up to about 1993. So there's still a lot of work to go for them. But that's really good. And they do it so well. It's funny, it's irreverent, but also they properly get into the music. That's a really good show. Sean Keaveney's Creative Cul-de-sac is good. I was a big fan of Sean when he was on BBC Six Music. I thought he was a brilliant broadcaster. And his podcast is really good fun as well. What else do I listen to? On a different tack completely, I really like The Rest Is History. I don't know if you've listened to that as well, which is Dominic Sandbrook and Tom Holland, two historians who each episode look at a different historical subject, literally going from, you know, the crucifixion and even earlier than that through to stuff that's happening today with Ukraine and Russia. And they've always got a really interesting take on that. So I really enjoy that. It also makes me think when I'm listening to it that I really wish I had become an historian rather than a broadcaster, which is something I think about often. But whenever I listen to their show, I think, oh no, I really wish I'd done that. So
still time.
More, I tell you what, let's have a quick look on my podcast app and see what else pops up. They're my favourite ones. I tell you what, another good one is, and I think you listen to this as well, Marv, is 80sography.
Yes.
Is, even though 80s musically is not my era, I'm a 90s kid, but Mark, who hosts it, is such a good host, and he gets brilliant guests on there. Yep. I mean, he did a 5-parter with Hugh Padgham, which was fantastic. I think they did 7 hours together over the course of however long it took, but he gets such good insights from the guests that he has on there. So even if I don't necessarily know a lot or like the person music who's on, I just think the process and the style that Mark has is so good that that's a really good show to listen to.
I loved the season on Tears for Fears.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because he got surprised, didn't he? I think Mark did, because he was doing it, and then he suddenly, I think he contacted one person who said, yeah, I'll come and talk to you. And then he was saying that it just suddenly, the floodgates opened. And he suddenly had all these people who were involved with Tears for Fears who said, yeah, we'll talk about them. And I think you've got 8 or 9 parts in that season. And it's fascinating how it's looking at the music of these 80s behemoths. And I'm hoping one of these days that he'll get Phil Collins, actually, because the 80s is Phil Collins.
No matter
what people think, you know, of him now.
Yeah.
The 80s wouldn't be the same without him. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's all right. And there was a Phil Collins podcast recently, I don't know if you listened to that, with Matt Everett, where I think they did it in a format of an A to Z. And Collins was on it, and they would talk about a different subject relating to each letter of the alphabet. But there was something that he said that has stuck in my head ever since, and I just can't get it out of my brain, because he was talking about how drummers, and you may know that it's been a musician, but how drummers refer to certain drum fills. And what is it? He said, a ticket, a check, a brap for the cash. And the cash is the symbol on the side. But the thing is, I can't help but go around with that in my head, going, a ticket, a check, a brap for the cash.
making noise like that all the time.
Yeah, I know. And the other thing I just wanted to say, Marv, is that I really enjoy listening to your show as well on Pods Like Us. I think it's a really good show that you do. And because it's almost twin tracks, isn't it? You've got, on the one hand, the guest is talking about the subject about which they're really passionate, which is really cool to hear people get excited about that. But then also to hear the kind of nuts and bolts of how they put their show together is really interesting as well. You know, and it's useful when you do another show just to say, oh, right, oh, I didn't know. Maybe I should do something a little bit differently like that. But no, I think it's a terrific show that you're doing. I'm dead chuffed that you've invited me on. I'm really grateful. And I'm sure, like all other podcasters out there, Marv, it's really nice when you give us a plug on your socials and in your blog and everything. It's really good. I think you do a terrific job championing independent podcasters. So, yeah, thanks to you as well.
You know, I'm British, so I might go red face. Good job. There's no lighting on me at the moment. But it's just... it's fun doing it, you know, and I mean, my own show, the idea is, like you said, the idea is that you get the nuts and bolts, which a lot of shows like mine do anyway. They talk to the people behind the shows and they get the nuts and bolts about it, about, you know, this is how they make the show, blah, blah, blah. And it's a relatively short format like that. But when I was approaching it, when I started it, I thought you could go that way, but then that's sort of just like a behind the scenes. Whereas if I take it that bit further, like with yourself today, we've gone into, in essence, I've introduced people to your knowledge of the subject. So now that makes people more interested then, because they know that the people behind these shows, they know where they're coming from then. So they know their knowledge base. And I think that makes it more interesting to people. It's more of an introduction to their show. It's like a micro version of what their show is, essentially.
Yeah. And it's a great way of signposting people, because I've listened to a couple of shows that I wouldn't have necessarily found had I not heard them on pods like us. So the Cool for Cats podcast is one that I've listened to because of the appearance on here. And then one more recently was the Tom Petty Project as well, which I've listened to a couple of episodes and have downloaded a few others to get to when I get a chance. So, yeah, no, it's a really cool thing that you're doing, Marv. So keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. So where can people find you and get hold of you?
You can get me on Twitter. We're at Dangerous Amuse on Twitter. I've got an Instagram, which is Dangerous Amusements. And I've got a website as well, which is dangerousamusements.co.uk, which has got a contact form on there, which is always nice when I get an email notification that someone sent me a message on there. So, yeah, any of those methods. You can see me frequenting coffee shops on Hope Street in Liverpool quite a lot of the time. And if you sit near me on the Cop at Anfield, you can come and say hello there as well. They're my usual places you can find me.
Okay, thank you very much for speaking with me today, Stu.
Oh, cheers, Marv. Thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you very much. You can find Pods Like Us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and also on TikTok, where I post up little clips from shows that I've listened to carry on from what Stu said. If something jumps out at me from a show, I might clip it and then put it up on there so that people have an idea of something that might interest them in listening to that show a bit more. And you can also contact us podslikeus@gmail.com. Thank you everyone for listening to me, and hope you listen again to another episode of Pods Like Us.